Yes, thank you for the kind introduction. precision behavior change was already addressed yesterday, and this comes from the Precision Medicine Initiative, which is a multi-million dollar initiative in the USA for a few years. And at the core of precision behavior change are the JITAIs. So JITAI means, this is an acronym, which means just-in-time adaptive intervention. So the idea is to do more precisely changes of behavior by being based on theory, being context-specific, just-in-time, being individually tailoring and being adaptive, including stage matching and other issues. So from formal health education, we move to just-in-time adaptive lifestyle coaching, which we have already discussed yesterday. So the outline of my talk are these four topics. So what is needed in psychology for precision behavior change? And then the main part will be the role of social interactions and social engagement in digital interventions. And then what else can psychology contribute? And finally, something about development, implementation, and evaluation issues that come up by these innovations. So what kind of psychological factors and models are useful or facilitating this movement? Of course, my position is theory comes always first, and this is not the case in many apps that you probably know, where software engineers and other very engaged and competent people develop apps, but they don't have psychological theory, which is a kind of problem, I believe. So there are building blocks which we can use in this development. Of course, there is a target behavior, and an obvious factor is risk perception, risk communication in one way or the other. Then there are the outcome expectancies, positive outcome expectancies or negative ones. I have an example here of a typical outcome expectancy. This is the semantic rule. If I eat more vegetables, then I will look more slim or happy or whatever. So there are social consequences, there are emotional consequences, there are health consequences, and so on. Typically, the health consequences are not the most motivating ones. I've developed these screenshots, by the way, for a conference on physical activity. This was an assessment demo of these constructs, which I did last year. So the intention or motivation in a more broader sense is a building block, the self-efficacy. Something like, I'm certain that I can do something, even if there are certain barriers, and there are different kinds of self-efficacy, and it is always behavior-specific for nutrition or for specific diets, such as fruit and vegetable consumption. And an organizational or skill-related factor is the action planning. This is the when, where, and how something should be done. And distinct from this is the so-called coping planning, which is on top of action planning, which means if there are barriers arising, obstacles or so, the person identifies them and develops a kind of plan B to cope with such kinds of challenges, such as temptations for snacking also would be an example where coping planning is highly relevant. And in JITAI, the most obvious is action control, because all JITAI applications have self-monitoring features, which are intuitive, of course. Now, the question then is how to use which theoretical constructs, in which context, in which order, in which dynamic setting. So one needs to develop some kind of theory-based behavior change strategies. And it's useful to make a distinction between motivational support systems and behavioral support systems, because not everyone is ready to change. So if someone is ready to change, then one can go directly into behavioral support systems. But if people are not ready, then one should start with motivational support systems with a purpose to build up motivation or build up a behavioral intention. Other issues here are staging and tailoring. Staging is usually group-based. Tailoring is usually individual-based, depending on the sample one has at hand. Different types of goal setting and intention formation, which are closely related to the planning types, and self-monitoring is some kind of key part in the action control business. So this is an example of a correspondence matrix. This is sometimes now demanded by journal editors or by reviewers when you write an article on this. They ask, please state explicitly which constructs have you used in your theory and which behavior change techniques are related to your constructs and which delivery mode is related to your behavior change techniques. So you set up such a correspondence matrix and to make clear to the reader what exactly you have done and whether it's really theory-based. Okay, then these set of constructs, factors, and so on need to be involved somehow in a dynamic model. This would be a process model here, where we have a hybrid form of stages on the bottom there, and some path analytic designs of what comes first, what comes later. So on the right side, the middle red part, this is a behavioral part where people initiate something, they maintain something, or they recover from lapses or setbacks. And before this, they should have planned, and before this, they should be motivated, which means an intention has been formed, and so on and so on. For intervention purposes, it can be a little bit simplified because it boils down to the left side or the right side. So the simplification is, shall we do motivational support in a certain intervention situation, or shall we provide behavioral support? And so there's a kind of watershed. How high is the level of motivation of our sample? And if we can identify this and it's high, then we just jump into the right side and do the main thing, which is behavioral support, improving the organization and skills and the confidence of people to make the desired change. And there are some variations of this model. For example, for the technology adoption, there's on the left side in the blue boxes, you see the perceived ease of use is sometimes important for people. We did this for a study on elderly who were supposed to use eye-related devices to measure eye pressure. So perceived ease of use was not clear to many of them whether they really find this easy to do. And the other one is their perceived usefulness. If I have this app, is this app really, really useful for me? So these are some interesting extensions that might be relevant when using dynamic models. Now, if we give these kind of models to a software engineer, he or she cannot do very much with it. We can run path analysis or structural equation models and so on, but a software engineer cannot make much sense of this, so it has to be translated. So then it looks a little bit different, and I come back to this later. Let me first do the main part here, the social engagement. So about 12 years ago, we did a study with the German railway company, and we did an online intervention, and it turned out this was a hard-to-reach target group, and people didn't want to sign up and so on. We found a way to improve the recruitment by doing interviewer-assisted online training. This sounds like a contradiction. Either we do online training or we'd have face-to-face coaching, so it's just the opposite. But it turned out that this was more efficient. People had lower attrition rates. They had better results later on that follow up and so on. So this was an example of expensive, resource-intensive one-to-one coaching, which actually should not be the case. Now, 10 years ago, one of my doctoral students developed a smoking cessation app, which is still running now. We have now 35,000 participants in this program who have lined up, who have locked in or have finished in the meantime, of course. So this is very popular, it's free, and one focus of this program was the social online engagement. So here is one set of data from 2010, I think. At that time there were 13,000, and the first day of non-smoking, there we had 3,700, and then it was less and less and less. And after 10 weeks, the program was over, more or less, and the sample was smaller. But there were some moderators, and this is the interesting part. There is a social forum. There were interactions possible and explicitly facilitated these kind of interactions. I skipped the German things here and focus on the English part. So there are three activities that were found empirically to be highly relevant for success in smoking cessation. One was the electronic bulletin board. So the users were asked after one day of non-smoking, or they got the option after one day of non-smoking, to upload their profile photo and write a few sentences about themselves, explaining why it was hard for them to quit and why they're happy now, and so on and so on. So this was done only by a small subsample, 826 volunteers. The others didn't like it. And then we did the survival analysis for 70 days, 10 weeks. And the smaller group is the green survival analysis. And the larger group below is the those who did not upload their profile. They stayed anonymous. So this made a difference, obviously, because the green survival curve is better, so they have higher rates of quitting. So this was one factor which was significant here. The other factor was donation. Donation was usually something like €5 or so, voluntarily, of course. So the question is, if someone donates money to this free of charge program, does it make a difference? Yes, survival curves that compare those who donate, 20% green line, they have better results in smoking cessation than those who did not donate their €5. And the last factor was message posting throughout the course. So how many messages were posted, zero or many? So on the upper survival curve, there are those who posted more than 7 messages over the 10-week period. They had the best survival rates, best outcome in smoking cessation. So these are three examples of social engagement that is correlated. I don't want to say anything about causality here, but correlated with success in an online program. Then we did, for a German insurance company, a diet and exercise coach, where we also implemented the social forum. This was also about 7-8 years ago or so. And you see on top there are some photos, and this is the nutrition part, and this is the physical activity part. There are more real photos. So people upload their profile, they say something about themselves, so they make it possible to have social interactions. And this turns out to be a factor that influences the long-term success of this online training. Here we also had a pedometer in addition. Now the latest project that's finished last year, we did in Spain, Italy, and Greece, also on diet and exercise, where we also used trackers. And a few features that were different. One was graphical planning. So instead of writing, tomorrow at 10 o'clock I will eat a banana, they just take the food with their mouse from a list on the left side and just move the food items into the calendar of the upcoming week. This we found quite interesting. Then we have this Facebook-type social platform. People were rated also in terms of their social activity. This is a dashboard. And then there is another feature, which is incentives. And that's why this program was called Credits for Health. So the idea was if people get credits, then they might be more interested or more stimulated to do more physical exercise or dietary changes. So they got, if they had received a certain number of credits, not only for physical activity and for dietary changes, but also for social interactions. So if they were socially very active, which can be logged objectively, then they got credits for social interaction. And the credit could be a voucher, for example, for something. They could redeem this in shops, in local shops in Florence, for example. Here is a restaurant in Florence that offered a 40% discount for people who have a certain number of credits for social interactions or diet or exercise changes. So although social interactions are in a way in contradiction to the digital intervention, it is a facilitator, and many people like this more, and the call is for kind of hybrid interventions where people have the chance to get more social contacts. And one of those is a new startup in India, the so-called Gokki program. The Gokki program is something they call an ecosystem, personalized healthy lifestyle coaching, where the app is in the center, but in addition to the app, they have coaches and trackers and medical consultation and health locker, and on the left side you see Karma. Now, Karma means they can donate some. They don't get credits, they don't get material incentives. They can donate something, and this is the same we had before. The question is whether donating something has the same quality we receive as receiving something. Is this possible? Yes, I mean, receiving money or vouchers, this is nice, and everyone likes it usually. But doing the opposite, donating something, means that I commit myself to something. I'm a good person. I commit something to Karma, which is an institution, a charity institution. So it gives myself a good feeling, so it increases my identification with this health behavior change program. And I'm involved in another program in Australia, which is not yet ready. It will be launched next year. It's called Me Squared. And this will work in the same way or similar way as the Indian Gokki system. And it's built on a precursor called Build My Body, which is running already. Build My Body delivers health food to the doorstep. So the profile is analyzed, and there's some interaction between dietitians and the user of the app. And as part of this, the program develops the ideal fitness diet for the user. And then at a certain time of day, then the food is delivered to the doorstep. Last week, we started collaboration with Oviva, which is a company in Switzerland, UK, and Germany. We have not yet done anything with them. Oviva is a personalized coaching system for patients. Many of them have diabetes or other metabolic diseases. And so they take pictures of their food, and a real human dietitian then sends back the feedback. And I've just tried this with my dietitian, and seems to work quite well. But of course, it depends on the quality of dietitian and the time resources, and as you know, there are lots of problems with this. So this was a social engagement part. What else can psychology contribute? As I said before, we, of course, the constructs, the dynamic models, and there is more, the user experience. This is something where psychologists have a lot of insight, improving adherence and developing the right cues for the right persons, tailoring EMA and finding out what process motivators are, which is not yet clear, and also the question when and where and how is context sensing possible. In terms of user experience, there is no official definition of engagement, I think. You can engagement define as a time on task, objectively measured, or you can measure the volitional involvement by self-report, asking them how much they enjoyed the work with the app and how much effort they have invested and so on. An area in which the psychologists have a lot of expertise is feedback. There is a history of this, and we are the expert. Not everybody knows this, but we are the experts. It starts with individual goal setting. So one can set a goal like 10,000 steps or 5 servings of vegetables or whatever. And then there has to be some kind of feedback by the app. And the simplest is just the goal attainment. So when the device says 10,000 steps are attained, then one can just give feedback and say yes or no, goal attained or goal not attained. This is the simplest way. This is criterion-based. But there are other options, the intra-individual comparison. One can say, well, this is worse before, a little bit worse before, much worse than before, or it's better, so one can give positive or negative feedback in terms of timing, more or less detailed. Or one can give social comparison, whether one is better than the other, better than a certain average, better than a companion, better as a defined reference group. And so there are 3 reference norms. This, by the way, dates back to 1954 when social comparison theory was first published. So we have 6 types of feedback, positive, negative, and criterion-based, intra-individual, or social. And then the question is, what shall we do? I mean, I assume that most software engineers do this just intuitively or have no clear theory about this. And this is a great opportunity to do research about feedback and reference norms using all these apps and having big data. And I don't know of any project that explicitly does such kind of research. So this is something for the near future, maybe. And if one makes this explicit to the user, one can also think about the option that the user says, I would like to have this type of feedback in the future, or that type of feedback. So then the social comparison is a bit complicated by the fact that there are so many social comparison standards. And one of them is the choice of reference groups, because people are usually in multiple reference groups or have multiple reference persons. This was from 1949, by the way, reference group theory. A lot of history about this. In the military, it started. So this is, as you know, the fish pond effect. This comes up also when we do this kind of comparison with apps. And one can do this explicitly by using collective feedback, for example, for the entire classroom. Your class is better than the others, would be collective feedback. Or one can use an entire city as a unit of analysis and unit of feedback. This is what we have here is a temporal feedback over a certain time period in this city that lost £1 million by diet and exercise. Famous case. Okay, and now I change the topic to another challenge, so one challenge after the other. This is context detection. I mean, GPS is in every smartphone, so the place is not the main challenge. There are other challenges. One has to distinguish between the user-induced, system-induced, and context-induced prompts or messages. And so there the difficulties come up. For example, smoking, snacking, and so on, triggered by certain cues. Yesterday we had the question whether one should also look for drinks and not only snacks, which Stephen asked, well, if someone drinks coffee and this is the main cue for cookies, then we have a situation, we have to find out when is coffee time for a certain person, because then we know for this person, coffee time means cookie time. So these are the meaningful moments, and this is something that psychology can identify by more or less qualitative research. Context is also social encounters. With whom are you at the moment? This is probably self-report and mental states. There are now some apps that try to identify depressive mood in a non-reactive way without asking people, trying to find out whether they are in a depressive mood or not. So the challenge for psychologists is to identify what is a high-risk situation for, let's say, smoking, snacking or so, and what is a high-opportunity situation for, let's say, physical activity or so. Now, I've invented a extreme case just for this purpose, invented this because this is rather absurd. I mean, diet and exercise is relatively easy compared to condom use. So let's have a context. A context is a romantic candlelight dinner with lots of wine and naked skin and music and so on and so on. And then a geofence can be easily established by GPS devices. And then we need some system prompts. The idea is that there's an intention, a plan, preparing use and actual use. So if we are before the situation, then one could use some psychological construct like anticipated regret. Or one can use self-efficacy to resist temptation, to behave correctly in the right moment. So a message could be something like this. Yeah, the question is how close to the encounter one can give such kind of message, and it could be too late. Self-efficacy is very hard to change, so, but what one can do is just assessing self-efficacy, because assessment itself has a treatment component. So by giving assessment tests like self-efficacy tests, usually people get a little bit more self-efficacious. And the same one can do for snacking, by the way, and so on. So then what kind of messages do we have in the system library? One option is, in a project, one can use a training phase. This is something which Bandura has made this with teenagers to prevent teenage pregnancy. In a training phase, the subjects, the participants, were developing their own sentences, their own phrases for certain scenarios. And then these sentences were stored and retrieved later on. So what one can do, one has a sample of people who may come in this situation, and they provide their own sentences which they regard as helpful for themselves. And then one builds a message library, and then in a situation, it is retrieved. So this would be one example of one such possible sentence if the person has stored this in the library. Which leads us to a main problem, which is the receptivity. So one has to identify the ideal conditions under which a message can be successful. And the question is whether sensing algorithms can detect such a situation. So I hope that Harald Reiterer with his group will do this very soon, or has already done this. He must be very close to this.
I will never disturb you.
So usually before an intimate encounter, it might be pretty difficult. So we have here the JITAI time points on the x-axis, and JITAI computes the likelihood of receptivity. There must be an algorithm. And the receptivity is very high in the beginning, which is maybe 5 hours before the intimate encounter. but then there is some fluctuation, and then at the deepest point there is the actual sex, so there's no chance to interrupt the person. But there's also a possibility to give messages after the event, because then it's preventive for the next event, next time. So it's not useless. So follow-up situations could be a possible good opportunity to intervene with such kind of self-produced messages. Okay, summary of the digital challenges. One has to define the meaningful moments for context-sensitive cues. The critical moment should also be distinguished as being self-identified. So the person says, well, when I go there in this place there I always drink beer or so when I go there, so I better don't go there. Or system-identified, whether due to the history of the behavior, the system can identify critical moments for the relevant person. And then the question, is it an opportunity or a risk or maybe both at the same time? I mean, going to a sports event is a good opportunity for physical activity, but then afterwards they drink beer and smoke after physical exercise, then we have a double situation. Repeatability, so this excludes certain behaviors such as vaccination. Vaccination is usually once a year or less. So if there is no repeatability, then it makes no sense to develop apps for this, because this would be then only a one-time app to improve motivation for vaccination. In the context where the person is really able to act, is a person mentally able to act, or is a person distracted by something else, this is a receptivity issue, then creating all the libraries for one particular meaningful moment, one might have 10 or 5 or so plausible interventions, so one would not repeat the same type of message when the situation comes up anytime. Okay, the other is clear. I now come to the last point, development and evaluation. So this kind of jitai is never finished. This is a main distinction to the usual intervention where we prepare the intervention 100% before it starts. We have a protocol, everything is standardized, it has to be standardized, so we can make the comparison with the control group. And we publish maybe a trial protocol beforehand to make sure that nobody fakes and everything is correctly done. So this is the left side, the classic perfect intervention where nothing should be changed. And on the other hand, there are the tools for jitai. Tools, these are the modules, the smallest meaningful, repurposable, and concrete modules. And behind this is the idea of agile software development. If you install Windows or Microsoft Office or any other software, it's usually not ready. The user becomes the beta tester. A few days after you buy software, there's a first update, and next week there's another update, and next month there's another update. This is not an accident. It is by design. The software is not supposed to be ready when you buy it. This is agile development. This is part of the entire philosophy of software development. Okay, so the dynamic intervention requires certain points, certain steps, decision points, tailoring variables, intervention options, decision rules, algorithms, and so on, and distinction between proximal and distal outcomes. And as I said before, if we give such a model, such a health psychology model to a software engineer, he or she cannot do anything with this. This is social cognitive theory by Bandura, where we have a few predictors and a target behavior. And now I show you the translation by a software engineer. This is by Martin and others, published a few years ago. And I've asked someone also to translate my path analytic design into a more useful diagram, and then it looks like this. So this is the cooperation between the psychologist and the software engineer, the informatics people. And another last point is the evaluation. If we have a classic randomized controlled trial, everything is clear, everything is standardized. We know we have a control group, we have a treatment group. They are randomized, and there are follow-ups, and there's a protocol, and so on and so on. But if we do JITAI, then everything is fluid. So there is nothing fixed, really. Next day can be different from today. So we don't know where the user will be next week. The user goes a certain pathway which we cannot predict, but we want to identify the active ingredients. How can we identify the active ingredients if we cannot randomize the person to a control group or an experimental group? So one answer to this is the so-called micro-randomization. So the factorial design which you need for identifying active ingredients usually with 16 or 32 or 64 groups, which is not manageable, this is put into a longitudinal design. So at every decision point, an individual is assigned and reassigned to certain treatments. So Monday evening is a decision point. Monday evening, a person is sent to an experimental group. He has to make a plan for Tuesday, and his neighbor makes no plan for Tuesday. So we have, for two persons, we have two different assignments for the next day, and there will be prompts and so on. And then comes Wednesday, and there's again a distinction between experimental group and control group, and so on and so on. So it becomes highly complicated and individualized, but this is how it's in line with JITAI. Related to this are the N-of-1 studies that are currently quite popular again after they have been popular in the 1970s, which is also a result of this kind of methodological dilemma that the classical RCT is not very useful. Here we have A-B designs doing something for 2 weeks and then something different for the next 2 weeks and so on. So there is a lot of literature and support of this, how one can do the repeated outcome measures in such kind of longitudinal N-of-1 trials. Okay, now I'm actually finished. I just want to mention that the psychological content remains more important than delivery technology. Sometimes the focus is moved too much to the technical part, I think, so we always have to think about psychological messages and their theoretical basis. We also should make sure that the client is not too much paternalized, because people like to have their own sense of autonomy and don't want to be guided too much by an app or anyone else. And you all know this sentence here that give a man a fish and you feed him for today, teach a man a fish and you feed him for a lifetime. We can now add something here, create a good tutorial, a good app, and he can teach himself how to fish. Huh? Thank you very much.
So thank you very much. I think there is kind of a lot of food for thoughts. I just have one very specific question and then kind of a general question. I found it really interesting that you find a positive effect by donating, actually, so getting money from people, which is kind of unusual. So do you have any idea why this is kind of helpful? Is this kind of a selective effect, so you have a specific sample, or it's kind of a general effect? Because that would be also nice to fund our research, wouldn't it be? But this is kind of a different thing. And the other question, it's more kind of a general question, because we had that discussed also very much in our group, thinking about psychological theories. I think they are kind of static, aren't they? They don't have really information about the timing of behavior. And you were saying the timing is also critical. So I would be interested in your thoughts about that, how to come to more kind of a theoretical basis also for the timing of the behavior. Okay, so one specific question, one more kind of general question.
I think the theories, the health behavior theories, will not be extended to timing, because timing is something that happens when you implement the theories, for example, by Jitai. Otherwise, there are just feedback loops. So at a certain time, there is a relapse, then people fall back. So there are time-related loops, but you cannot say that certain things have to be in a certain time. I mean, the trans-theoretical model had specific time phases for the different stages, which is, I think, obsolete. I think this doesn't work so well. So I would rather not do this. In terms of the donations, yes, if I donate something, then I commit myself to something. So what is cause and effect is not quite clear here. But if one can make people donate something, then they are committed to continue doing this. Yeah? So maybe you try to ask everyone to donate 100 euros if they start with the app and then they are more successful.